It's good to see everyone this morning. We're glad that you're here. And again, we want to welcome all those who are visiting with us. I want to take just a moment to echo already the comments that have been made about Emily being baptized. We're just so proud of you, honey, and appreciate very much all the young people that we have here that have seen the need to become Christians, to dedicate their lives to Jesus Christ, that their sins might be forgiven. I think that's just wonderful, marvelous example. And so we very much appreciate her. Have you ever noticed that there are certain phrases that tend to be used when someone is coming to the close of their prayer? You can sometimes even tell that that prayer is coming toward the end by just the things that someone is saying. It's the same way when you have the close of a phone call. There are certain things that we kind of say that start to signal that this is the end of our call. Years ago, when Amy and I were living in Kansas City, Missouri, we had a deck outside our back door, and the people just right down the, like a couple of houses down, were Christians. They had a deck outside their back door, and they had a parakeet that was a pet of theirs. And the parakeet could, or parrot, I guess it is, that could talk. That is, it could mimic the sounds that it heard. And it just mimicked all sorts of sounds, and it mimicked the owner and his phone calls, at least the beginning and then the end of his call. And it was just so funny. We go outside on our deck and then, you know, we kind of just hear him. Hello? Okay. 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 Bye. And that's just kind of the way we are. It's the same way with the close of letters. There are certain things that we tend to say as we're winding down a letter. That was true of the New Testament letter writers also. We've been studying in our auditorium class the book of 1 Thessalonians. We have been a little bit off schedule of late. We've been looking at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and the last few verses of this chapter are verses I'd like to talk about in our sermon today. And that will allow us to then start with 2 Thessalonians on Wednesday night. By the way, let me just say for those of you in that auditorium class that it would be good for you to go ahead and for Wednesday night read through the book of 2 Thessalonians. But when you look at the latter verses of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, what you see are Paul making some closing comments. And he does that typically in his letters. But I'm going to say to you that the closing remarks, they're not unimportant. In fact, sometimes it's the closing remarks that are things that are very crucial in our minds, maybe very urgent when we're writing someone a letter and then closing that out. Or sometimes maybe it's parents when they're giving some closing instructions to their children prior to the parents leaving. Sometimes the last few things that you say are really important because they're really urgent. And I think that's what you see here. I won't have time to look at everything that Paul says here in these closing remarks in 1 Thessalonians 5. But I would like to look at some of the things that Paul says. And they're really important. Paul says in chapter 5, verses 12 and 13, he talks about the need for them to appreciate those who are laboring among them. Notice what he says. But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Now, people ask the question, who exactly is Paul referring to? We maybe immediately think of local elders, and yet there's not been any reference to elders in the Thessalonian letter. It seems to me that probably Paul is immediately thinking about those who would be acting on his behalf and giving that apostolic teaching to the Thessalonians, maybe Timothy, maybe Silas, maybe even bearing this letter of 1 Thessalonians as they would return to that church and then continue to instruct them in that apostolic teaching. I think it may very well be that that's who Paul is referring to. But ultimately, even if that is the case, the words that Paul uses certainly apply to those who would be then ultimately appointed as elders over the Thessalonian congregation. In fact, you see in the New Testament that this was the pattern of action, that after a church had been established in at least some period of time, there would then be those who would be appointed from among that group to be the shepherds, to be the local overseers of that group. And what they're doing is on a regular basis, then giving that oversight and giving that instruction to that congregation and watching out for them in very much the same way that certainly Paul would have done when he was first there in establishing that church, or an apostle would have done. But you see in God's plan, elders being appointed over a local congregation of God's people so that on a regular basis, those men can then be exercising oversight and leading and instructing the members of that flock. And so Paul's words here are so very important. He says, you appreciate those who diligently labor among you. He goes on to say, you esteem them. You know, this is something I think that's very important for a congregation to really do, to appreciate those who have been appointed as the spiritual leaders of that flock. The writer of the letter to the Hebrews says this in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17. Very similar words to what Paul wrote the Thessalonians. He says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. Such a marvelous picture that God has created here for us. The idea of a congregation of his people, and there are those who have the responsibility of a spiritual leadership and oversight and watching for dangers and trying to help all the members of that congregation to get to heaven, to be the kind of people that the Lord wants all of us to be. And so these New Testament writings indicate, make sure you appreciate those people and make sure that they're able to exercise that leadership with joy and not with grief. And the Hebrew writer goes on to say that that would even be unprofitable for you. May I just say on behalf of all of the elders here how much we appreciate how all of you fulfill what these New Testament writers say. I absolutely believe that. I can't tell you how many times in prayers that are offered here that the elders are made mention of. Y'all are so good to ask God's blessing upon us, and we need those kinds of prayers. You're so commending of us, and absolutely, as these two passages that we've been looking at indicate, you show us your appreciation, and you make this something that we can engage in as a labor of love and in a joyful way, and not as a difficult and grieving task. And I certainly appreciate that. I think all the elders do. But this is what Paul says here as he closes out his letter to the Thessalonians. I want you to think about something else that he says to them. He says in chapter 5, verse 27, have this letter read to all the brethren. Just a simple statement. Have this letter that I'm writing to you now read to all the brethren. And what you see, and you see it not just in this passage, but you see with Paul throughout his writings a concern that the things that he's writing to a particular congregation, he wants every member of that congregation to make sure that they have that information. He wants them all to make sure that everybody has that read to them. In fact, even the way that he words that have this letter read to all the brethren, you're aware that in that ancient world, not everybody could read. In fact, most people couldn't read, or at least couldn't read well. And even so, they would not have their own copy of all of these letters that would be written by apostles. And so what you would have is probably, say, one copy, at least initially, that would then have to be read to everybody else. And that's how people would get that information. And so Paul shows his concern here about people getting all that information. It wasn't just his concern with the Thessalonians. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 1, when Paul addresses his letter to the Corinthians, he addresses his letter to the saints there at Corinth, along with all those who are throughout Achaia. That's the province where Corinth was the capital city. In other words, what he's implying there is that this is a letter not just for you at Corinth, but this is a letter that all of those who are throughout the entire province who are Christians, it's for all of them. Now, it obviously had a peculiar purpose for those living in Corinth and that particular congregation, and yet the implication is you make sure that all the people in the province of Achaia who are Christians, make sure they all get a copy of this letter. Make sure they have that information. And that's what you see in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 16, where the Apostle Paul writes his Colossian letter, and he makes reference to the fact that this letter needs to be read to all of those in Laodicea. He says the letter coming from Laodicea, I think he means Ephesians, that needs to be read to you. In other words, he's talking about these letters that Paul was sending to particular churches in the province of Asia, they needed to make sure that all the Christians in their area, they all got access to that information. And it therefore should be no surprising when you look at 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. Here is the Apostle Peter, and he's writing a letter to the various Christians throughout the not just one province, but five provinces throughout what we call Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And he makes reference here to all of Paul's letters, which those people would be familiar with. He talks about how the things that Paul writes are sometimes hard to understand, how people can sometimes twist them. And yet he is expecting those Christians throughout all of Asia Minor to be aware of Paul's letters. How can he expect that? Because these New Testament letters were being copied and spread and distributed, and people were reading them, and they were having them read. And it's not just these New Testament writings, these apostolic writings. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 13, there the Apostle Paul says to Timothy, you give attention to the public reading of Scripture. He means the Old Testament Scriptures. Give attention to the public reading of the Old Testament Scripture along with exhortation and instruction. In other words, what these verses are talking about is how important it is for people to learn all the things the apostles wrote, for them to learn the Old Testament Scriptures, for them to have access to that information, and not just have access to it, for them to really understand what was being said and taught by those apostles and what the Old Testament writers were saying and were talking about. All of that information, that's what was being read, that's what was being studied in those congregations of the Lord's people in the first century. And as Paul concludes his letter to the Thessalonians, he reminds them of the need for them to make sure that this is read to everybody now. May I just say this to us? This is why in this congregation, that's why we have our Bible classes. We call them Bible classes. But what are we doing? We're reading and we're studying the apostolic writings, like the apostles were commanding to be done. We're reading and we're studying those Old Testament Scriptures, like the apostles of Jesus commanded should be done. And we're exhorting people and instructing people in regard to all of that. That's what our Bible classes are for. May I say, nearly everybody takes full advantage of those, but not everybody does. We need to make sure that we're taking advantage of those Sunday morning Bible classes, those Wednesday night Bible classes, where we can give attention to the reading of the Old Testament scriptures and the reading of these New Testament apostolic writings like God's apostles were commanding. That's what all that is about. And so if you have not been taking advantage of that, and there are some who obviously haven't been, you need to change your behavior. You need to change that pattern. Make an observation to you, if I may. And I've said this recently, but I think it bears repetition. There are three times when the New Testament refers to the people of Jesus Christ as Christians. Three times, only three. That's kind of the most common designation that we use to speak of ourselves. Someone asks you what you are religiously. I'm a Christian. And so we use that terminology. I'm a Christian. That's certainly fine for us to use that. That means a follower of Jesus Christ. That's what that term means. And that's absolutely good and fine and proper. But the New Testament only uses that designation three times. That's all. But I can't tell you how many times it uses the term disciple. Disciple. And the term disciple means a student, a learner of Jesus. The imagery is exactly what you see with the ministry of Jesus, where he would travel around Galilee and the surrounding regions, and he had a band of disciples who would travel with him and who would hear his instruction, and they would be able to then ask him questions and gain that instruction, and they were his learners. That's what it meant to be a disciple, and that's the most common designation that the New Testament uses for those who are followers of Jesus. Disciples, students, learners. I wonder this, if we would call ourselves most of the time disciples, I wonder if that might not affect kind of how we view ourselves. Because you call yourself a Christian and you can maybe in your mind think of yourself as being a Christian even when you're not really learning the word of the Lord. You're not studying those apostolic writings, not studying the Old Testament writings. You can still maybe think of yourselves as a Christian, as a follower of Christ. But if you view yourself, and if we speak of ourselves as disciples, as students, as learners of Jesus Christ, it might affect, in a very good and positive way, how we view ourselves and maybe the importance of taking advantage of these occasions where we apply what Paul wrote here to the Thessalonians. I want you to think about that and see if there's not some personal application that some of us need to make there. What else does Paul say? We can't look at everything, but in verses 16 through 18, here's what the apostle says, and I think it's just really an interesting thing that he says here. He says, "Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus." That's a very positive statement. Rejoice always. And that's interesting when you think about it, and when you put this in historical context, because as we've said many times in our study of 1 Thessalonians, what's going on with the Thessalonian brethren at the time when Paul writes this letter is that they have had anything but joyful times, at least as far as how their city has been treating them and how their city officials have been treating them, how the non-disciples among them have been treating them. Because they've been persecuted for the cause of Christ. And yet Paul says here, rejoice always. And don't think that Paul kind of had his head in the sand about this, or that maybe he was kind of saying this, but he himself didn't practice what he preached. He himself didn't have this kind of a positive mindset, even in the midst of difficulties. No, I'm reminded of what Paul says in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 4, where he writes to another church in that region where Thessalonica was. He writes them just a few years after writing this letter, and the church at Philippi, he says to them to rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. And what makes it so significant that Paul says that is that when he writes it, he's under arrest and he's a prisoner. Probably in Rome, where he is awaiting possibly his own execution. Not because Paul was a lawbreaker, but because he was preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ and standing up for it. And yet Paul still writes to the Philippians, rejoice. We have reason to rejoice always in the Lord. He writes that to the Thessalonians, rejoice despite the fact that currently things are not going real well in your life. Rejoice in the fact that you have something much more important that is your destiny. And God has determined it for you. It's your place in His eternal kingdom in the world to come. And that's what Paul held on to. That's what allowed Paul to have this kind of attitude. And he says in conjunction with this rejoicing attitude, he says, pray without ceasing. May I suggest to us that we need to make sure that we are being prayerful people. And when Paul was writing the Thessalonians at the conclusion of his letter and giving them final urgent comments that he felt were urgent, he reminds them to pray without ceasing and express your thanks to God always. What's it mean to pray without ceasing? I've talked about this before, but I've had people say, well, you can't pray 24 hours a day, so it can't mean that. So what's it mean? Well, just have a prayerful attitude for 24 hours a day. I've never quite understood what that meant. That's not what he means. It's not hard to understand what he means. Pray without ceasing. No, he's not talking about praying 24 hours a day constantly. But what he is talking about is that we, if we have a proper kind of prayer life of a disciple, we are praying to God on a regular basis. It's just like how you eat to sustain your physical body. You don't eat 24 hours a day. Well, maybe some people, it kind of looks like that. I keep going the way I'm going, it's going to look like I do. But what we do is we eat on a regular basis and we don't stop eating. And that's what Paul was saying about their prayer life. Pray without ceasing. Don't ever take a fast from prayer. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of us do. Paul knew that. For some reason, when things are not going good, when maybe we think there's not some reason to rejoice, we have a lot of problems in our life, for some inexplicable reason, what we tend to do is to stop talking to God about those things. Paul says, don't ever do that. In fact, if we would be talking to God on a regular basis about even the problems that we have in our life, what we would discover is the problems that we have in our life, as severe as they may be, they're really not as bad sometimes as we think they are. Because when we're praying to God about these things, it tends to put us in a context where we look at things from God's point of view. We see the big picture. We don't just think myopically. We don't just think in a selfish way about ourselves. If we're praying like Jesus taught his disciples to pray, we see ourselves as one praying disciple among many praying disciples who all have the same difficulties, who all have the same struggles, and it causes us to have a different attitude. And maybe even a little bit easier to look at our life and to say, you know what, I have a really joyful life. I have reason to rejoice. And so I want to urge all of us to pay attention to the admonition that Paul is talking about here. Pray without ceasing. Don't neglect your prayers to God. Talk to Him. That's all prayer is, talking to God. Talk to Him about your problems, about your difficulties, and don't stop doing that. And Paul goes on to say in this little section, and give thanks to Him. And when you pray, if your prayer life is what it needs to be, you will not be able to help but to thank God for the things that you have. Paul reminds these brethren to please do that. And then the final thing that Paul says to them, that among the things that I don't have time to talk about, at least one final thing that I will mention, in chapter 5 and verse 22, he says this. He says, abstain from every form of evil. Abstain from every form of evil. And that probably is connected with the preceding statements he makes about prophetic utterances and that type of thing. So there is probably some connection there. But nevertheless, I won't talk about all that right now. Nevertheless, what Paul does say is this expression, which even if connected with the previous verses, does have a generic quality to it. Abstain from every form of evil. The old King James Version rendered it like this. Abstain from every appearance of evil. A lot of us are familiar with that. Every appearance of evil. And unfortunately, since the King James worded it that way, what happened is a lot of times maybe preachers and brethren have kind of misunderstood exactly what Paul means by that. That verse, abstain from every appearance of evil, has been taken by a lot of people as if it's talking about our example, as if it's talking about even if you're maybe not doing something evil, don't do something that would appear as if it were evil. So you give some kind of a bad example. Well, let me just say to you that even though I certainly don't think that we need to do something just purposely that would make us look like we are committing something sinful, even though we're not, that's not what this statement is talking about. Avoid every appearance of evil is not talking about just don't do something that looks like it might be evil. No, that's not what the Greek word means. It's talking about the fact that evil can take a lot of different appearances. Evil things can take a lot of different forms. And that's why most modern versions render it, avoid every form of evil. That's really the point. It's kind of like when I was a kid and I'm having to weed the flower bed. And it just seems like I couldn't believe all the different kinds of weeds that would come up. I mean, there were just all different appearances of weeds, just all different kinds, all different forms. That's kind of the way evil is. And Paul says to the Thessalonians, there's a lot of different forms of evil out there. You abstain from those. You avoid those. And let me just say to you, in our world today, there's a lot of different forms of evil. In Romans chapter 1, verse 30, Paul was delineating the sins of the nations, and one thing he mentions always impressed me. He talks about those who are inventors of evil. It just seems like human beings have a capacity to just come up with new ways to sin. It's just a new form of sin. It's the same sin, but maybe it's a new way of doing it. And there are just all sorts of different ways in which you can do evil things. And Paul was saying, you avoid that. We live in a world that's different from how it was even years ago. So many new ways to commit sin. Just this past week, I was tending to my parents. As you know, I've got elderly parents. I was over there and helped my dad. He was in his room. He's watching television. It's the old Andy Griffith Show. Okay? One of my favorite shows. Love it. These young kids have that. What is that? I don't even know what that is. He's watched the old Andy Griffith Show, and of course, you know, it's a little bit of a caricature, but nevertheless, a reflection of rural America as it used to be. And so Dad and I were just talking and kind of watching the episode, and there was some little poignant moment in the episode, and Dad just kind of looked over me and he said, Marty, our world sure has changed from the way it used to be. And I thought, sure has. It's not the same world. I mean, it's not the same world that I grew up in. Let me just say, you teenagers, I will just admit to you, I think you have a harder time. I honestly do. I think you have a harder time living for Jesus Christ at your age in this world than it was for me and others my age when we were having to live as teenagers in our world at that time. It just seems to me that it's harder for you. Because in our world now, there are so many things of an evil nature that we just wouldn't have dreamed would have been available. And so many easy ways to do sinful things. Whereas it used to be you had to maybe go out in a public way to do sinful things and people would know. And now you can do things in private and now it's secretive. And now you can bring things into your own home that are immoral and ungodly. And all these things that are of an addictive nature. And there's just all these new ways to do sinful things. All these new inventions of evil. And it's just tough. It is tough. And what Paul said to the Thessalonians 2,000 years ago, it's just as applicable for us now. We need to avoid those things, abstain from whatever form it may take. And what that means is we can't be naive and just think, well, when I was growing up, these are the things that I had to steer clear of, as if that's the only thing you need to be concerned about with your kids. There are new ways to sin now. There are new evils and new forms of evil available now. We've got to be on guard against all those things and not be naive. And so Paul says, as he closes his letter, please make sure you abstain from every form of evil that appears on the scene. Closing remarks. Things you want to say at the end as you wind down your letter, but things that are not unimportant, no, things that are very important and very urgent for all of us to heed. Are you here this morning and not a Christian? We hope that you'll become one. If you've not been baptized into Jesus Christ, you need to understand. The Bible teaches that's how our sins are washed away. That's how we can become a child of God. If you've not done that, we sure want to help you do that. And if you've not been living as a Christian, can we encourage you to change your life and do whatever you need to do, whatever we can help you do to make those corrections? We would love to be of assistance in that way. Won't you let that be known? Well, together we stand and sing this song of encouragement.